My grandfather went most of his life without using or needing encryption. But now we live in a time where encryption is intertwined in almost all of our electronic communications. That shift to go from a world where everyday people didn't use encryption at all to a world where everyone uses it and doesn't even know it was a major transformation. And there was nothing easy about it. There were powers at play that didn't want everyday people to encrypt their messages. But human rights and civil rights activists fought and fought and fought. You know the outcome of this story, but you may not know what it took for us to get here. So let's take a journey through time, back to the 1990s, and understand exactly what were to be known as the crypto wars.
This is Darknet Diaries, true stories from the dark side of the internet. I'm Jack Reesider.
Before we get started, I feel like I should say something. It's really hard for me to stay neutral on this topic because I'm such a privacy and security advocate. This is a topic that's important to me, and I'm staunchly on a specific side. So upfront, I just want to say that I apologize if I don't represent both sides fairly in this story. So to help take us through this pivotal piece of history, we have a very special guest.
My name is Cindy Cohen, and I'm the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The EFF is a nonprofit digital rights group. It helps protect your civil liberties online. Cindy has been with the EFF for over 20 years, and she's played a crucial part in the crypto wars, as we'll soon discover. But before we get into her role in it, we need to take a quick glimpse into the history of cryptography.
Cryptography has been used by military people to protect their plans and share information, say across, you know, between the generals and the front lines for as far back as Julius Caesar. Caesar had a cipher, right, that they used. And in World War II, there's some great stories about how the ability of the U.S. forces to break the German code, the Enigma machine, which they were using to code, had a tremendous influence on the ability of the Allies to win the war. And there's great stories about both the, you know, the code breakers in Bletchley Park breaking the German code. There were also really successful efforts to break the Japanese codes, and lots of people will I think quite credibly say that the Allies' ability to break encryption codes had a lot to do with us actually winning the war.
Encryption is when you take a message and encode it in such a way that if someone else were to get that message, they would not be able to read it. But then whenever the receiver gets the message, they would be able to decode it and read the message. This is also known as cryptography.
The military has always viewed encryption as a part of, you know, part of its tool set, right? Part of what they needed to do in order to help us win military wars. And the U.S. State Department keeps a list of called the U.S. Munitions List that has all of the things that the government treats as a military tool, such that it can't be exported without a license from the government. And so the U.S. munitions list is pretty long. It has things that will be, you know, it has tanks and surface-to-air missiles and, you know, submarines and things like that, that you can't, military subs, that if you build them or a piece of them, you need to get a license from the U.S. government before you export it.
So during the Cold War era, sometime in the 1970s or 80s, the U.S. State Department added cryptography to the munitions list.
And it wasn't particularly important to the rest of us because the rest of us didn't really need to have strong encryption in what we did every day. So that's kind of what the world looked like heading into the early days of the internet. The shift came as the internet was getting to be developed, especially in the kind of early 1990s, you know, just before the World Wide Web, but when a lot more people were beginning to think about what the world would look like if we had, everybody in the world connected via digital technology. The realization that we were going to need to have privacy and security in this new world, and that encryption was one of the ways that you could get it, was fairly obvious to a lot of early thinkers about this. And so suddenly this thing that wasn't particularly relevant to the rest of us, the fact that the government controlled encryption technology, suddenly became very relevant as we started thinking about how to build an internet that would really work for everyday ordinary people who wanted to do commerce or have a private conversation or, you know, use this technology to, you know, develop new tools that they might, you know, need to protect as trade secrets or keep confidential, and also keep the network secure. Encryption does both of these things. It both keeps things private and it keeps things secure. And so it emerged as one of the really important technologies that we were going to have available if we were going to have an internet that really worked for everybody. The government created an encryption standard that it let people use so that there could be at least some encryption, but it was very, very weak.
This standard was known as DES and stood for Data Encryption Standard. With it, you can encrypt your data or a message, and anyone who reads the encrypted message could not understand what it said. And the person receiving the message had a key to decrypt the message. But by the time the internet was taking shape, DES had already been around for 20 years and was starting to show its age.
And most cryptographers, most mathematicians knew this for years. By the 90s, DES was clearly not, you know, not good security anymore, and the government was kind of pretending like it was. And one of those situations in which the government policy people wanted something to be true, that DES was really secure, because they had backdoored it, because they knew that it wasn't really secure, and so they could always break it, and were pretending like it was really secure and hoping that nobody noticed. But of course, people did notice.
So the government knew 40-bit DES encryption was not very strong, but insisted we use it anyways.
A guy named Bobby Inman, who was the head of the NSA in the 90s, but there are other people as well who, you know, were making representations about DES that were, you know, I think not really true. And I don't, you know, you have to either think that they knew what they were talking about and were basically trying to convince the rest of us that it wasn't, or that they didn't know what they were talking about, in which case it's a little troubling because they're the NSA.
Businesses and banks were digitizing their data, and the need for all this data to be encrypted slowly became more and more important. The early 90s was a place where
people are engaging in various kinds of protest activity, political organizing, all of that sort of activity. Encryption is tremendously important for people who are trying to change the government, who are trying to change corporate policies, who are trying to stand up for building a world that is better than the one that we have. And we know that the U.S. government has traditionally spied on people who are engaging in political protests. We know they spied on Martin Luther King. We know they spied on John Lennon. We know that they spied on, you know, all of the civil rights movement.
This is why PGP got started. Phil Zimmerman, a software engineer, developed a much more secure way of communicating called PGP, which stood for Pretty Good Privacy. And he helped human rights activists use it. He put his PGP code on an FTP server for anyone to download and use. And while Phil said he did not spread it outside the US, it eventually found its way to the other side of the US borders. Because cryptography was considered a munition, Phil was investigated by the US Customs Service for violating the Arms Export Control Act. This would be the same violation if someone were to export Stinger missiles outside the US without an arms permit. Businesses were originally fine with DES as the standard, even though they knew stronger encryption existed, because in the 80s, the only adversary to businesses were other businesses, and they knew other businesses didn't have strong crypto analytic capabilities. So even if it was weak, nobody had the ability to crack it except for governments. But it started to become clear that other nations were trying to develop ways to break DES. So businesses were starting to get a little worried and wanted to use stronger encryption. So businesses started using PGP as a form of communicating trade secrets and sensitive data. And using PGP internally was legal as long as the encryption didn't cross the US border. For the next few years, Phil would be continually investigated for spreading his encryption method around the world. A case was brought against him by the government for violating the Arms Export Control Act. And from what I can tell, the battle between Phil Zimmerman and the US government was the first battle of the crypto wars. The users of the internet, security companies, and banks were all starting to request higher and higher security encryptions to be used by the people.
And on the other side was the military and law enforcement saying, no, we need to keep the encryption weak so we can catch the bad guys. We were pointing out that, most of us would rather be secure in the first instance and not get robbed than have very low security, but slightly increase the chance that they might catch the robbers afterwards.
In 1993, Bruce Schneier published a book called Applied Cryptography. This book describes various cryptographic algorithms and how to use them. It even contains algorithms which were not allowed to be used on the internet. An electronic engineer named Phil Karn asked the U.S. State Department for a commodities jurisdiction for the book. He wanted to know if he could legally ship the book across U.S. borders. And since there's no export regulations on books, he was given permission to export the book. So then Phil Karn took a few pages from the book, which contained some cryptographic algorithms, and placed them on a floppy disk. He then requested a commodity jurisdiction for the floppy disk. The State Department had a discussion with the NSA and denied the request. We know they had a discussion with the NSA because of records requested through the Freedom of Information Act years later. Because the encryption was in electronic form, it was now considered a regulated munition and was not allowed to cross U.S. borders in that form. This created quite a controversy. A book containing a mathematical algorithm can be sent across the border, but a floppy disk with the same algorithm cannot? So Phil Karn sued the US State Department. He believed that if the data contained in a book is considered protected under the First Amendment, then data contained on a floppy disk should also be protected in the same way. And once Phil Zimmerman heard of this lawsuit, he decided to print his PGP source code in a book format. He even took great care into making the book easily scannable. He too asked for a commodity jurisdiction on his book. But the State Department was now more aware of the situation and did not grant him the right to export the book. However, they didn't deny him either. The State Department just sat on the request for a while. Phil Zimmerman's publisher didn't wait for a response. Instead, they started shipping the book containing his PGP code all over the world. The security community took this in various other directions too, such as printing algorithms on t-shirts, which would then make the t-shirt a regulated munition. When something is a regulated munition like that, you can't even allow foreigners to read the t-shirt. Simply wearing that shirt in front of a foreigner violated the Arms Export Control Act.
So several things happened. I launched a team from EFF, with EFF lawyers, launched a lawsuit against the encryption technologies. There were actually three lawsuits that were filed. We handled one called Bernstein versus Department of Justice.
Another cryptographer named Dan Bernstein was developing encryption methods that were above the regulated limit. In 1995, Bernstein wanted to write about his encryption, give talks about it, and publish the source code on the internet. The Arms Export Control Act and the International Traffic in Arms Regulation required Bernstein to submit his ideas about cryptography to the government for review, which also required him to register as an arms dealer and to apply for a license. All this simply to publish his ideas about cryptography to the internet. Bernstein decided to do battle against the US Department of Justice, and he got help from the EFF, specifically Cindy Cohen herself.
Yeah.
The EFF took their best lawyers to go and help out Bernstein.
Yeah, that was exactly what the goal of the litigation was, to make sure that people could, publishing on the internet always is an export, right? Because everybody in the world can see what gets published on the internet. So we wanted people to be able to publish and share strong encryption on the internet. To get there, what we did was we argued that computer programs, computer code, was protected speech under the First Amendment. and that the government's regulations of that speech in the form of the munitions list regulations were not consistent with the First Amendment.
So for the next year, Bernstein, Cindy, and the EFF did battle against the U.S. Department of Justice. In 1996, a professor at Case Western University named Peter Younger also joined the battle.
Yeah, Peter Younger is the third case. He also was arguing that he was a law professor, but he also had a computer science background. And he argued basically the same thing as Professor Bernstein, that he wanted to publish code as well.
Not only did he want to publish code to the internet, but he also wanted to teach a class on cryptography. But because he included cryptography as a topic of his class, he was restricted from accepting foreign students in his class. This resulted in Younger challenging the export laws as well.
So that case was going on in Cleveland. Our case, EFF's case, was going on in California. And then Phil Karn's case was going on in D.C. And the three of us all kind of worked together to try to, make sure that we were putting as much pressure on the government as we could collectively.
By this point, there were numerous businesses expressing a need for stronger encryption for their data. Banks in particular were requesting the government allow them to use a stronger encryption method. Specifically, the U.S. government was not allowing encryption that was over 40 bits in length to be used on the internet. And around this time, AT&T created a phone that would encrypt a phone call. It basically created a modem connection from one end to the other and digitized the voice and then did a DES encryption on the data. AT&T sold these phones for $1,400 in the mid-90s. The U.S. government freaked out about this phone. They contacted AT&T and said they have a better solution. The government had been working on a new way to encrypt data electronically using a specialized computer microchip. The encryption was far superior to the common DES, possibly even unbreakable. The government called this the Clipper chip. The government developed this chip for anyone who wanted to use stronger encryption. And so, a solution was found. The government urged AT&T to use the chip on their phone. AT&T was hesitant at first, but the government offered to buy a bunch of these phones if they added the chip. So AT&T added the Clipper chip into the phone, and the U.S. government bought a ton of these phones. But in the features of the Clipper chip, there was one rather large asterisk. The Clipper chip had a backdoor key built into it, which allowed the government to decrypt any message encrypted by the chip. The government was basically allowing people to use rather strong encryption method, but had a key to break the encryption if they needed it. The idea was that the government would be the only one who would ever have the key.
And one of the things that happened right after that got released is a guy by the name of Matt Blaze, who's now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Computer Science, a very famous computer science professor, demonstrated that these Clipper chips were really insecure and demonstrated what we all kind of know is true right now, is that you can't build a door into strong encryption and only expect the good guys to ever figure out what the key is, to ever have a key to it.